Welcome back to part two of our double podcast episode with author D.D. Johnson about his new novel, Disneyland. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I recommend you go back and listen to that first.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 alla mattina.
Before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder that we're only able to keep producing these podcasts, both working class history and literature, thanks to support from our listeners on Patreon. Our supporters fund our work and in return get exclusive early access to podcast episodes, bonus episodes, free and discounted merch and other content. Join us or find out more at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Link in the show notes.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
In part one, Darren started talking to us about his new novel, Disneyland, which imagines the response of a Scottish working-class community to the end of the world. One thing which listeners would have picked up on is that Disneyland is written entirely in a Scots-inflected dialect of English. The use of Scots has a long tradition in Scottish literature, so we spoke to Darren about his motivation for writing the novel in the way he did, and about the relationship between Scots, Scottish English, and what is generally considered standard English.
I think Disneyland's written in an East Central Scottish dialect of English. But firstly, I think it was, why would you not, you know, because I do think that that language is really beautiful, and it's got sort of rhythm and verve, and it can have a harshness to it at times, and it's just very, very rich, I think, that you get that development of language, and that's something that's always happened, and that's not something I think to be afraid of at all, because in fact that's sort of it's finding new diversities of language and new cultures, and it's out of exchange and meeting. So where I say that it's written in East Central Scottish dialect, loads of those words are Romany words, you know, words like Barry and Gadgie and Dougal, and they all come out of Romany. So that, I think that's really rich, that sort of diversity. What concerns me is the internet, right, is sort of written in, almost all of it is written in, it's like the same American English that Friends was in, you know? It's, hey, hi, how you doing? You know, and that, there's a sort of monoculture there. And the relationship between Scots and English is pretty complex. And at what point, you know, you say something Scots, and at what point you say it's a dialect, you know, that sort of thing folk get into arguments about. But there's, if you think about other dialects, and as I say, I think what I'm writing is a dialect of English. You think of other dialects of English and their uses in literature, there's a similarity and a difference, right, in terms of, I don't know, if you were to look at writers from Liverpool and writing in Scouse dialect, right, to an extent, there's a lot of similar issues that apply in terms of why you do that. But there's a big difference in that Scottish has this written tradition. It was once the, you know, going back to sort of 14th to 16th century, it was the language of the nation, of both in terms of literature and official business and what have you. So you have these written forms, and that, although after the Acts of Union you get an effort at anglicization, there's a legacy, you know, the sort of guys like Burns and Ferguson are writing in a Scots vernacular as a reaction against that Anglicisation. And although you get various points of which the use of Scots is seen as being, you know, a revival of it, it never really goes away. So in that sense, it's a wee bit different from the case if you were looking at, I don't know, Geordie or whatever. But in other ways, it's similar in that there's a period in modernity where there has to be a linguistic and cultural centralisation as part of nationalism. And that's true of English, but also, you know, the same process happens in other countries. Like, remember there's a quote from an Italian nationalist at the time that sort of the Italian state was created, and I think Massimo Zeggi or something is his name, and he says, let me see if I can remember it. He says, we've made Italy, now we have to make Italians. Because I think something like only about 1.5% of the people in that area of Italy were actually speaking what we now consider Italian. And when everybody's living in their own wee glens and doing a bit of crofting and what have you, it's all right for them all to be speaking a bit of Lowland Scots here, a bit of Gaelic up there, you know, and probably struggling to communicate with each other. You get them all in one city, working in one factory, they go start speaking the same language. And so you get this centralisation. And if you want to be part of the share of power, you want to participate in that, then you have to use the dominant form of language. And other forms come to be sort of repressed and marginalised. And using them comes to either mean that you're sort of disadvantaged because you don't have the skills to participate in the sort of discourse of state and power and what have you, or it's a sort of an act of rebellion to an extent. And that's how certain, I think, like, attitudes towards Scots are changing a lot. But certainly when I was at school and growing up, you'd be encouraged to speak correctly, and correctly meant not using local words, local grammar, etc. I mean, I think, like, James Kelman's been really influential for me in terms of how he's, over many years, advocated for the idea that Scots can be used for the whole story. There's this tradition that goes back at least to Walter Scott of you have the dialogue being in Scots and then the narration's English. And that's what I did in my first novel, you know, where the Scottish characters speak Scottish and then the narration's in sort of standard written English. And in terms of how it interacts with nationalism, again, I probably, you know, share Kelman's suspicion towards all forms of nationalism, including Scottish nationalism. But that doesn't necessarily mean, like Kelman, I think, has said that if he was going to vote in a, you know, another or independence referendum, he'd vote yes for an independent Scotland. I've never voted in any election in my life, and it's not a, I don't live in Scotland, so if there's another Indy ref, I'll not be voting in that one either. But it's a difficult question given the different political feeling in Scotland and the lack of representation for that in a UK government. If you're sort of opposed to government, it's not easy to know how to align yourself on that. But the only other thing I'd say about wanting to use Scots or any other form of non-hegemonic language is that much as there's that process of nationalist centralisation in terms of what language can be used during modernity, in late modernity or post-modernity, whatever we want to call it, there's something similar happening at a global level. And in recent years, the extent to which US economic and military power is being translated into political, cultural, linguistic power is massively accelerating. That's being facilitated by the internet. It almost parallels to me like the sort of destruction of cultural diversity is almost like the destruction of biodiversity.
In part one, we also talked about the influence of apocalyptic or dystopian fiction on Disneyland. However, another less obvious influence, both on the structure and content of the novel, are the apocalyptic prophecies of the radical pre-Enlightenment Christian tradition.
You know, the apocalypse, it's become this awful, terrible thing, you know, and I think that we've lost our enthusiasm for the apocalypse. I've forgotten that this used to be something that we were in many ways to look forward to. Yes, a terrible sort of time of reckoning. But ultimately, it was going to deliver us a kingdom of heaven on earth. And a while back, I got really into reading about and actually going to visit places that were associated with a lot of older revolutionary movements from before the Enlightenment. I got interested in sort of the radical Christian groups that came about around the Reformation, sort of millenarian groups, and you know, Thomas Munzer and Jan Matthys and all these sort of pretty crazy guys often. But with this faith that there was going to be some great reckoning and that the evildoers that were often the, you know, the princes and the lords, the people that kept the peasantry oppressed, they were going to be just smited away by God. And then we were going, and I mean, come on, eh? That's pretty appealing, is it not? You know? And I think modern political thought, you know, on a large extent, it comes out of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and that includes the anarchists and other libertarian tradition as well. They tend to be fiercely secular. But that idea is still there. You know, like that famous quote from Buenaventura Durruti during the Spanish Civil War when he's saying, you know, the bourgeois may blast and destruct its world before it leaves the stage of history forever, but there's a new world growing in our hearts and we're not at least afraid of ruins and all of this. It's that similar sort of idea that there's going to be this rupture and then something new is going to be born. And of course, I'm not wishing like a cataclysmic rupture on the world. That would be terrible. But as a metaphor for some sort of radical reassessment of how we're going, some sort of reckoning, I think it's interesting. And it is a book about faith to an extent. In terms of, for many years, right, I thought that you could change the world by appealing to people's self-interest, right? So you'd argue with someone, you say, well, you should join the union because, and you should join the union, we'll go on strike because you'll get more money. Well, that doesn't follow at all. In fact, it's not in you, it's in no individual's interest to join the union, go on strike. Let other people do it. You'll still get the pay rise. The reason why you do that is because of some belief, because you feel it's right. And I don't think that you can ground that belief in some sort of objective morality. You know, I sort of agree with Nietzsche about that, that you say, well, you should join the strike on union because if the union does well, that's going to lead to a more equal society and that's fairer. Well, why should it be fair? You know, there's no sort of way to end those sort of questions except that you believe in it and it requires a wee bit of a leap of faith. So all that was going on with the book, and I wanted to start where the sort of apocalyptic disaster scenario that we see play out so often, but give it back its fun element, you know, get some laughs in there.
One source of laughs in the novel comes from a group of characters dubbed the Survivalists of Dundule, led by a misanthropic fantasist called Hobbes.
You know, I've got a character in the novel, Hobbes, who's he's a prepper, a survivalist. He's been one of those guys who's all getting his guns ready and he just can't wait for the end of the world to come. And he's convinced that it's basically going to go down like a zombie apocalypse movie. And him and his buddies, they go out and they camp in an adventure playground and they're sort of satirised and ridiculed. But that name, of course, comes from Thomas Hobbes, the English Civil War era philosopher, and his idea that in the absence of strong authority, we can revert back to our natural state, which is the war of all against all. And that warning, I think, runs throughout a lot of disaster fiction, a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction, and a lot of our literature generally.
Darren is about to read out a passage that exemplifies and makes fun of that kind of trend in post-apocalyptic fiction. In this passage, Hobbes and his two followers that make up the Survivalists of Dundule begin their eager preparations for the end of the world and the war of all against all that that entails.
Anyways, as you can, on the night of the rioting,
Kieran goes to meet Hobbs out at the adventure playground. Now, Hobbs chose the adventure playground as the site of camp survival when they used to train there. He'd timed them as they climbed into the treehouse, zoomed down the flying fox, edged along the balance beams, galumphed across the tire traverse, hopped from log step to log step, scrambled over the clamber net and sprinted up the slide into the play fort. But parents gave them grief for thudding up the slide in army boots. Some bairn's da went mental when Kieran knocked his toddler off of the balance beam. In the end, they had to quit the playground after Bodkins received a sexual offenders prevention order. Nonetheless, on their first night, when the ignorant masses, the zombies as they call them, are all looting and burning, the survivalists of Dundool lash tarpaulins across the roof of the playfort and climb into their shelter via the kiddie-sized ladder. Kieran lies awake, listening to the thunder snow, feeling all snug and proud. Because while the likes of Ruth are getting hypothermia, the survivalists are prepared. They've got bivy sacks, Arctic-grade sleeping bags, Gore-Tex camel suits. While the zombies are all shiting themselves about what they're going to drink, the survivalists drink the water for the dual burn, either boiled or purified with tablets. While Giorgio's supplies are being looted by a gang, the survivalists are surrounded by natural defences. To the north, the playground's protected by the canal. To the west, it's fortified by Breast Mountain. And to the south, across a thicket of hawthorn, nettle and bramble, a barbed wire fence surrounds flat grazing fields. The only weak spot is to the east, where the playground's car park is fed by a wee road that comes round from behind the museum. Now, this road crosses a tributary of the Avon, near where the burn meets the canal. So Kieran and Hobbs barricade the bridge with a fly-tipped cooker, a rotten sofa, the springs of a mattress, a rusted fridge freezer, all this kind of thing. While the zombies are risking typhus because they can't flush their kludges, Bodkins digs a toilet trench in a copsey elder and hawthorn. And Bodkins, right, basically looks like a bairn off of a biscuit advert. All freckles and dimples and blue eyes. So he's forever trying to make his appearance less boyish. Many times a day he checks the progress of his tash, like a gardener checking on a prize marrow. But nobody else even kens he's supposed to have a tash. So, as he digs the kludgy, he takes a moment to wipe streaks of dirt on his cheeks, because he thinks that'll make him look more manly. Anyways, when the trench is deep enough, Bodkins spikes the spade into the excavated dirt and invites Hobbs to christen the new toilet. Well, Hobbs slips down his over trousers, unbuckles his belt, yanks down his combats, drops his antimicrobial kecks, and stands exposed in the frozen air. He hunkers down, feet astride the trench. To begin with, nothing happens, then you can hear a wee trickle of piss. Hobbs stays squatting, arse pointing into the trench, and they all stand around until he manages to produce. "Brothers," he says, wiping his arse with a frosty dock leaf, "the new world is born."
This passage is obviously mocking the grown-up fantasies being acted out by the survivalists. But the novel is also making a broader, more serious point in its contrast between the survivalists and the wider community, about cooperation versus competition, and how humanity organises itself to survive catastrophe. This contrast can even be seen in how Kieran imagines the ignorant masses succumbing to violence and hypothermia, and the reality of how Giorgio and others come together to support each other in the passage read out in part one.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
There are some parts of Disneyland which even seem to parallel the work of Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin and his book Mutual Aid, A Factor in Evolution, about which famous paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould maintains that, while flawed in places, quote, Kropotkin's basic argument is correct, end quote. That is, Kropotkin argues that even in nature, survival isn't just a case of the strongest will survive in the sense of all against all. Instead, using a range of studies, Kropotkin concludes that mutual aid is, quote, the surest means for giving to each and to all the greatest safety, the best guarantee of existence and progress, bodily, intellectual, and moral, end quote. And, moreover, that, quote, those species which best know how to combine and to avoid competition have the best chances of survival, while the unsociable species decay, end quote.
I wouldn't, go further than that and say that human nature is essentially benign or that we're innately good or anything. But what I would say, and what I think is the flaw with all the arguments about our supposed human nature, is that our only nature is our necessary sociality. Like we're born ridiculously early, totally unable to look after ourselves, you know, for years, sort of increasingly into our mid-20s, it seems. So there's just no possibility. There has never been, will never be a human that is nature. It's always to do with how they're nurtured. And part of that is that, you know, you just look at a baby and the ways that they want to reciprocate and respond to other humans, and they want to share their food and share their toys, and they have this capacity for love. And we probably didn't spill as much ink thinking about our capacity for love and kindness as we do thinking about our capacity for savagery.
Indeed, one key theme in the novel is precisely this potential for love and kindness. Moreover, it shows how, even if started for reasons of pure practicality, like just keeping each other warm, as in the passage read out in part one, the act of cooperation has the power to transform people.
Ruth never used to like talking. It was one of the things that had to be done, like putting out the recycling or periodically changing tariff with your energy provider. See, everybody lived separate lives, raised separate families, lived in separate homes and distant neighbourhoods, pursued esoteric hobbies, and devoted themselves to jobs so specialised or alienated that they seemed pure pointless to anybody now employed in the same field. She'd go to dinner parties and do the whole "and what do you do" thing, and often listen to some poor bastard try and explain the highs and lows of being an equity derivative flow trader. Or, and this was even worse, she'd often watch them glossing over as she blathered on about her monograph on John Dryden and millenarianism. Or she'd be like, "so what do you do to relax?" And then she'd be stuck for follow-up questions when the guy turned out to be an ornithologist that was eager to tell her about a white-winged scoter he'd spied at the Eskmouth some year back. And because such conversations were so grim, folk, understandably, resorted to the one thing they shared: consumption. Like, sometimes men would discuss their consumer choices as car buyers, or women would discuss their consumer choices when choosing new clays or kitchens. Mixed groups discussed the cost of membership at different spa clubs, or they shared their consumer experiences holidaying on different Greek islands or dining at a new restaurant where the food was cold or the service was slow or you had to try the tartare. But most of all, they discussed their consumption of culture. They talked about who'd read that year's Booker winner, and was it no awfully good or rather dull or just so sad at the end. They debated the social importance of Motown, whether Kurt Cobain was the last rock star, whether Rima Laidlaw was feminist. They talked about a new Guardian article on CGI or a Times piece on the Metropolitan Opera. And you ken yourself how it goes. Cos they'd nae other way to relate to each other, they talked about these things like they mattered. They fell out politely cos somebody agreed with a 5-star review for a new Tarantino film, or said Leonard Cohen should nae have got the Nobel Prize for Literature. They politicised their responses to entertainment, made them into points of morality. They disdained alternative viewpoints the way union members had once disdained scabs or congregations had once disdained heretics. But ken what? Though these conversations were repetitive and pointless and acrimonious, they thought them way superior to the mundane chit-chat they overheard via the tables in bars and restaurants and coffee houses. They scoffed when they heard a table of co-workers gossiping about their manager or debating the best strategy for restructuring the office. It was a truism that there was nothing sadder than going out and talking about work. But now Ruth sees that shared endeavour is the sole basis for meaningful conversation. Much of the work that she and others devoted their lives to was Sisyphean in its pointlessness. But the conversations such work generated were nonetheless the best conversations they had. Now, every conversation is underwritten by shared endeavour, by collaborative effort. Ruth can't stop chatting, can't stop listening, can't stop asking questions. She's laughed more these past 10 days than she laughed in all the preceding decade. It's enormous.
This is actually one of my favourite passages from the book, not just because of how it captures the way our relationships are structured by capitalist society, but also the way it imagines how they could be different. In particular, the line about shared endeavour being the sole basis for meaningful conversation points to how even our interpersonal relationships might change if society were organised differently. It's also a change that we can find glimpses of today, as anyone could tell you who's experienced the excited conversations that take place as a union drive or community campaign heats up. And it's an excitement that infects us as readers as we watch Disneyland's characters build a new society where shared endeavour begins to underwrite every interaction. This idea of radically restructuring society comes across far more urgently in Disneyland than it does in any of Darren's previous novels.
I think that sense of urgency in the new novel comes from just a feeling that time is short and the stakes are incredibly high. You know, like they're talking about the direct action ecological movement and anti-capitalist movement all that, you know, 25 years ago. And at that time, we were saying, hey guys, you know, this is beginning to happen. You've got to watch out for this. You know, it's on the way. Now you can feel it. You can feel it on your skin. You can see it again and again and again that the climate's changing. You can see it in the wildfires and everything else. And that's really frightening. The speed at which our ways of living and interacting with each other are changing is frightening. The COVID lockdown, it's quite possible, I think, to be simultaneously concerned about the virus and its effects on vulnerable people and deeply frightened by this unprecedented extension of state power and what it means that you can have a society where there has been that experiment in people never leaving their homes. And we're having children, again, it makes the stakes higher because it's just worse when things are going to happen to someone that you love. You know, if the world's going in a terrible direction, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy and I don't want to write myself off yet, but I've not got masses to lose. But when I look at my wee boy, and yeah, it does feel urgent. And also, at the height of the pandemic, my work started a redundancy process by email, totally unnecessarily, you know, they were just a sort of periodic thing. And I had that sort of faceless tyranny of bureaucracy to deal with. And getting poorer it's a shock. You know, if you're used to being fairly comfortable, doing all right, and suddenly you're thinking about the cost of living and stuff, it's not what you expect. You know, you expect that prosperity is going to increase. That's the promise of capitalism. And this is probably the first time in a fairly long time that people are feeling, well, prosperity isn't increasing. We are in real terms getting a whole lot poorer. So it does feel urgent. And sometimes it's hard to see sources of optimism. And maybe that's partly why I've turned to this fantastical idea of a parallel society and a big collapse and finding a happier world through that. Whereas the first novel, it was about the failures and possibilities of a political movement that really existed.
Ultimately, a powerful core of optimism remains at the heart of Darren's novel in how characters come together and form bonds of solidarity. This isn't because any of the characters are uniquely good individuals. But what Darren does so well is to imagine entirely plausible reasons why flawed and at times selfish people would cooperate to build a better world. One great example of this is Giorgio, a character who returns from Darren's first novel. Giorgio's character arc between these two novels is fundamentally one of redemption and seems to suggest something about the capacity of even the most flawed individuals for positive transformation. In this part, Darren mentions the French writer Michel Houellebecq, who it should be noted is an Islamophobe and supporter of France's centre-right president Emmanuel Macron. However, as frequently happens in literature, even reactionary authors are capable of using their talents to provide moments of great insight, the poet T.S. Eliot probably being the most famous example of this.
I think that, to an extent, your characters are always elements of yourself. You observe the external details of all sorts of people and these characters' mannerisms and all that on what people do, but in terms of their inner worlds and motivations, you can only really know your own. You know, there's a great quote from Gustav Flaubert, and he was getting hassled to reveal who he'd based Madame Bovary on. You know, someone was saying, who's the real Madame Bovary? You've got to tell us. Who's she really based on? And he said, Madame Bovary. He said, what? She's me. And the same way the characters, you know, at the start, when they're not very nice, that's all me. And then there's this healing process, you know, as they develop. It's sort of maybe as therapeutic thing like that. But bringing Giorgio back, you know, Giorgio, he gets a bit of a rough deal in the first novel, doesn't he? Like he's portrayed as a bit of a loser, and then he gets horribly beaten up. And generally, I feel enormously warmly, forgivingly towards individuals. There's very few individuals that I don't have sort of sympathy and empathy for. And most of my anger's always displaced onto systems. And I know that systems are just the actions of individuals, but maybe because I've so often felt powerless with the way that systems shape my life, that's where I tend to feel anger. So I don't sort of have a grudge against George or anyone else, and I wanted to bring him back, and I wanted to redeem him. And I guess it's that, like, mainly I write about, we've talked a lot about politics and jobs and class struggle and all of that, but mainly what do you write about? You write about love and death. There's nothing else that really matters. And Disneyland's a book that, it's a book that's born out of how much I love my son, and I hope that there's something of my love for people who can often seem obnoxious and annoying and are trapped in systems that aren't your choosing. But I continue to have a great deal of faith in them. There's another book about the end of the world as we know it, which is maybe, there's a writer, it's maybe an unlikely one for me to mention, but I'm thinking of Michel Houellebecq's Atomized. Michel Houellebecq, he's a sort of very, he's a very sort of provocative right-wing French author that, but, you know, kind of brilliant. And near the end of that, he writes tortured, contradictory, individualistic, quarrelsome, the human race was capable of extraordinary violence, but it never quite abandoned a belief in love.
That's it for our double episode in conversation with D.D. Johnson about his new book, Disneyland. As well as our previous bonus content about Darren's involvement in McDonald's workers' resistance, we also have another bonus episode in which we discuss more of Darren's writing, where Darren reads another passage from his new novel. Both of these available exclusively for our supporters on Patreon. It is only support from you, our listeners, which allows us to make these podcasts. So if you appreciate our work, please do think about joining us at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Link in the show notes. In return for your support, you get early access to content, as well as exclusive bonus content, discounted merch, and more. And if you can't spare the cash, absolutely no problem. Please just tell your friends about this podcast and give us a 5-star review on your favourite podcast app. If you'd like to read some of Darren's novels, check out the webpage for this episode, where you'll find links to buy them from an independent bookshop. You'll also find links to his website, ddjohnson.uk, as well as sources, further reading, and more. Link in the show notes. Thanks again to our Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible, and special thanks to Stone Lawson and Jazz Hands. Our theme tune is Bella Ciao. Thanks for permission to use it from Dischi del Sole. You can buy it or stream it on the links in the show notes. This episode was edited by Jesse French. Anyway, that's it for today. Hope you enjoyed the episode and thanks for listening.
Morto per la libertà. E questo è il fiore del partigiano, morto per Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.